Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Good. I figured out a segue I can do from that point. But before we jump into that, just wanted to check in and see if you've had a chance to listen to Sarah Kenyon's Data and Drams episode that she dropped. I think it was last week for the first episode.
Not yet, actually. No, I'm quite excited to. It's lined up on my podcasts app. You know, I usually listen to podcasts either when I go for a run or if I'm commuting.
Yep.
And as I haven't done either of those things yet this week, I haven't put on a podcast.
Fair enough. No, I had a listen this morning.
But looking forward to it. Yeah, how was it? Was it good?
It was really good.
It looks good. Look, like I've been seeing what she's been posting about it, and it looks like she's got some really incredible guests lined up. Some you know, really exciting conversations. I'm pretty keen to give it a listen, actually.
Oh, absolutely. I found, because I'm like you, or predominantly when I'm listening to the podcasts, it's usually on a commute.
Mm.
But by commute, I mean while I'm driving in the car.
Yeah, I mean that too, except for it's an hour and a half for me.
But the reason I make that differentiation is I'm gonna have to go through it again because I need to start taking notes.
Yes. Yeah.
So listening to it while you're running or driving is probably, you might want to do a once through, but I reckon you'll be sitting there afterwards going back over it, taking a few more notes. There are some good takeaways out of that.
You know, it's funny, you would think that in 2025, in the, you know, the tail end of 2025, we'd be in a position where if we're running or in the car, we could pause it and say to some kind of AI assistant, take a note, highlight that, bookmark that, even start sending off agentic tasks where we say, I want to look this up and cross-reference it against this. And I want to draft an email to Liam saying, I want to talk about this on our next episode, you know, all kinds of things like that. I feel like the promise of AI and agentic AI is kind of, it's not unrealistic, but I feel like we're being teased with it at the moment because we're not there yet.
Yeah.
But it's definitely like, yeah, I'll tell you an interesting parallel to that. Thinking about .NET MAUI, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a subject that is dear to me, and it's something that I know a little bit about and, you know, care about.
You wrote a book about it, didn't you?
I have read a book about it, yeah.
You wrote a book about it, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. Sorry.
Quick
I haven't
question.
Mentioned
did
it for my, a while, so I just slipped my mind.
Yeah, quick question. Did my sound just get better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Yeah, annoying fan on my work laptop just decided to stop.
Yeah, okay.
I did write a book about it, yes, and it's been very successful, actually, depending on your measure. Yeah. No, but it's
you're retiring on the royalties yet?
I beg your pardon?
Retiring on those royalties yet?
The royalties are definitely retiring. Let me put it this way. I'm just finishing off my tax return because we're obviously very close to the deadline now.
Yep.
And I won't be owing the ATO anything this year. But no,
back on topic.
Like when MAUI first came out, in fact, before it came out, obviously there was Xamarin. And I obviously liked Xamarin. A lot of people did. And there was, you know, it wasn't without its problems. It was good, but it was a bit finicky for the first couple of generations.
Mm-hmm.
I think we actually spoke when we had Brendan on the podcast.
Yep.
Brendan Minnick. We kind of brought this up as well, which is where I said that when it comes to Xamarin Forms specifically, when it wasn't until really sort of version 3.5 that it was stable, like really good. Like version 4 was rock solid.
Yep.
3.5, anything earlier than 3.5, it was quite hard to use unless you were a real expert. But 3.5 was stable, and then, you know, people could use it, and then 4 was really good. And then of course 5 came along and they said, well, we're not doing this anymore, we're going to move to .NET MAUI. So a few people got, yeah, upset. But anyway, what the vision for MAUI was really good, and a lot of people got excited about it, and obviously Microsoft built up a lot of hype about it before launch, and then they delayed the launch because it wasn't ready, and then they thought, well, we can't delay it anymore, so they launched it, and it, you know, it wasn't ready. Like the first version of .NET MAUI that shipped with it was actually .NET 6, believe it or not. It just wasn't really good enough for prime time use. And in mm-hmm. fact, I made a decision with the book that I was going to say in the book, it's not going to work. It's not going to work if you try and use anything earlier than .NET 7, because for me to make the samples that I had in the book work with .NET 6 was just taking up too much space in real estate in the book that I couldn't spare for workarounds and stuff like that. So I said, look, .NET 7 minimum. And .NET 7 was a lot better. It was still had its idiosyncrasies, shall we say. And then you know, 8 came along and 8, I think, was stable. And then 9 came along and again, 9 was rock solid. Like 9 was really good. Now we've got 10 coming out in a couple of weeks. And I've got to tell you, 10 is amazing.
Yeah.
It's really good. And the thing is, the thing that's interesting about this is that if you look over the past 4 years of the lifestyle of Maui, you see this. If you imagine kind of community excitement as a curve, there's this massive spike, like peak, like right early on. And then it dips, but it doesn't just dip down to like, you know, the y-axis. It bottoms out, like shoots down way below it. Yeah. And I wouldn't say that this is the sentiment of the community as a whole, right? But there are a few loud mouth dickheads. Yeah. I'm just going to say it, right? And you see this like a vocal minority. Yeah. You see it on Reddit. You see it on GitHub. You see it in any kind of space where people on the internet have the shield of a screen. That's not true, actually, because people are like this in real life as well. In fact, someone sent me a video this week of someone, you know, quite personally with his face and everything, doing a bit of a critique of the new Insiders Build of Visual Studio. And it's a little unprofessional, shall we say. Anyway, but yeah, you see these people saying, you know, Maui is dead. It's terrible. Don't use it, blah, blah, blah. And I saw an interesting comment on one discussion where someone was saying, maybe it was me. Maybe I said this. I can't remember. It sounds like something I would say. I just can't remember whether I did or not, or whether I saw it and thought, that's clever. I should say that next time. But it was something along the lines of, if someone is crapping on Maui and saying it's shit and telling you about all the problems with it, ask them what cross-platform mobile framework they use instead. If they have an answer, great, then they've probably got a valid opinion and it's worth hearing what they say. But if they don't, then they're just ranting for the sake of ranting. Anyway, bit off topic.
Valid, right? Very valid.
Yeah, bit off topic. But the point is you can really see the sentiment even outside of the kind of core Maui community now. People that are starting to try the betas with or the release candidates with .NET 10, especially like the performance improvements in AOT, it's so fast now. Like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of it's hit its stride, and for all the worry that people might have had about the naysayers and the people literally circling for blood, I always try to say people are trying to like manifest its demise, you know, they believe that if they say it enough it will be true. But you know, even that is kind of fading, and you're really starting to see, as I said, even people outside the core Maui community and the broader.net community saying, hey, I've tried this is really good, I like it, it's working well. Something else interesting, actually, and I've got to be very careful what I say, because this was an initial meeting with a client and they haven't even told me anything yet, because I need to sign an NDA, but it's about a potential mobile app, and they have a existing app with a different, that's built with a different cross-platform framework, and they've been very unhappy with it. And the person that's leading this endeavor initiative has worked with a bunch of different cross-platform mobile and desktop frameworks and has found Maui to be their favorite and is the one that they've had the least problems with and most success with. So, and they didn't even say that until the end. So I kind of said, you know, I lean towards Maui, and I was trying to be professional and say, you know, we as a team can work with anything. This is my preference, blah, blah, blah. And yep. Even that, when they were saying about the other framework, which I won't name, that they were working with, and they said, you know, we've had lots of problems with it, so on and so forth. And I asked them to share some of those problems, and the framework that they are using is not without its problems. It's basically like any other software system. It's got problems, right? But what was interesting was the problems that she was describing are kind of problems that you can't really attribute to the framework. They're things that should be solvable.
I was going to say, are they more problems attributed to the fact that it's a cross-platform application?
No.
Okay.
No, these would be implementation issues. But yeah, I mean, just harking back to our last episode, which I really enjoyed, by the way, I really enjoyed that discussion, the one on SQL and NoSQL and that sort of thing.
Yep.
But I mean, yeah, so just harking back to that, like notwithstanding my comment that without, you know, based on a very short discussion and without having actually seen anything, the problems that this person was describing seem to be implementation details. Different frameworks do guide you toward the pit of success.
Yes.
In some areas.
We've discussed that in the past too.
Yeah. Yeah. So from that perspective, you know, I also agree that Maui is a really good choice, and I'm really happy to see that it looks like it could be about to kind of find its stride, and I'm just really pleased about that.
So anyway, that's it for this episode?
That's it, yeah. But what I was saying, the reason that I went off on that little tangent is because, first of all, because as I said, I'm very sleep deprived and my internal checks and balances are not in place, so I kind of opened a floodgate and out it poured. But no, like I feel like we're in that space with AI at the moment. There's obviously a big difference, which is that I don't think most people have the choice of saying that's not ready, I don't want to touch it. It's everywhere and it's not going away, so everyone kind of has to buckle in for the ride. But I feel like it's kind of, because I'm having some frustrations with AI at the moment, and it's very easy for me to recognize that those frustrations are because the technology and the infrastructure around the technology and everything else that we're building around it is in its infancy.
Yep.
Part of that scares me a lot. Just thinking back to our chat with Yuli, like the pace of change and the way that I see things going at the moment and the work that's being done, it's all very good and it's all very exciting, but everyone is falling all over themselves not to get left behind. And it's not even about being first to market, right? Or being, you know, first mover or anything, right? It's about not being left behind. And everyone is falling all over themselves to do all this kind of exciting stuff. And I just use that example of that book, Cat's Cradle, again. Like, this, if there was ever a time where we needed some good kind of robust, slow and steady, you know, do things right approach, and it's literally the opposite of what we have right now. Anyway, would you like to hear about my frustrations with AI? Would you like to tell me about your frustrations with AI? Would you like to tell me about your frustrations in general?
We can turn the
recording off if you like.
I was going to say, we try to keep our episodes to under an hour, right?
Yeah.
Now, look, I feel I'm not, my opinions are not too dissimilar to yours there, right? We are in its infancy. There's the big risk of being left behind because it is moving so rapidly. And I think, again, it's almost going, well, very similar to the Web3 idea that it's a solution looking for a problem most of the time. There are genuine, absolutely genuine use cases for it. But a lot of the time when you're looking at it, people are just using AI for the marketing benefit of it rather than the actual technical benefit.
So,
I mean, that being said, though, right, I've absolutely been, you know, I love using Copilot to help me as a pair programmer get through a lot of stuff that is not within my circle of expertise.
Yeah.
Right? Things that I'm not 100% sure or certain about, bouncing ideas off it that way, or asking it to do a rough draft in that space and still throwing an eye over it. And I think it's great in that space. I've tried to use it in the way of sort of trying to vibe code up actual applications or something useful, and have failed absolutely miserably.
Interesting. This is what I wanted to talk about, but yeah.
Right. And I want to dig into that one a bit more. But the other one I just sent you the other day too is basically using it as a ghostwriter just to throw together a rough novel that I want to read.
Yeah.
Right. And actually using it to bounce ideas off, to develop characters, to develop the plot line, to develop the chapter outlines, and then just to actually write out the chapters, read through them, offer suggestions, updates. I don't like where this is going. I think it should be done, you know, the characters, that's not what I intended the character to do or whatever. And offering that feedback and sort of, I guess, vibe writing in that space.
Yeah.
And that's been quite interesting. And it's almost like a choose your own adventure novel where you actually are completely choosing your own adventure, but you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be a linguist or, you know, a great wordsmith, because those, you know, I'm not a writer, I'm not an author. There's certain skills that I don't have. But if there's a book that I want to read that doesn't exist, then I can get the AI to write it for me in a choose your own adventure kind of fashion, right?
Yeah.
And that's been fun. It's nothing more than just having a bit of fun with that.
When I edit this, by the way, I'm going to splice in that audio clip from Fight Club where he says, "I am Jack's inflamed sense of rejection."
I don't know that one. Oh, it's been so long since I've seen Fight Club.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't know any of the quotes from it.
Okay, never mind. As you were.
But back to the failure with the vibe coding. Yeah, either it's my use of the tools or the tools are not fit for purpose. And I sent you a link or a video the other day from on YouTube from Scott Hansman and Mark Rusinov.
Who are they?
Did I say that right? Yeah.
From Microsoft, right? Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Rusinovich.
Mark
Rusinovich, yeah.
Okay.
The SysInternals guy who's now CTO of AI or something, isn't he? I don't know. Yeah, I was just being facetious.
No, that's all right. I want to retake that so I can actually pronounce his name properly. Rusinovich. Yeah. So I sent you a link the other day, or a video from Scott Hansman and Mark Rusinovich from Microsoft.
Yeah.
They've got a podcast series that they're doing, and they were talking about AI-assisted coding.
Yeah.
And they've spoken about it in the past. And one of the things, I can't remember which one was saying it, but I think it was Mark was sort of saying it's great as that co-pilot, that pair programmer.
Yeah.
And it's, if you want to vibe code with it, it is fine for the very basic of the most basic applications. But once we start getting
I disagree on that point, but I'll get to it. Keep going.
But once you actually start getting into anything of relevance and anything, you know, that we would be doing most of the, or sort of our bread and butter, anything that's a bit more complicated, it's hard. As again, I think it was Mark was saying, and I'm just trying to remember certain aspects. project. But in large enterprise systems, or in, you know, asynchronous systems, when one action happens, something will happen down the track.
Yeah.
But it's not clear in the code path.
Yeah.
Right. And like the context, the size of the context, the size of the memory that the LLM has cannot take into account that entire problem space.
Yeah. Okay. I probably should watch the video. But it's interesting because you've touched on so many things that were real parts of what I wanted to talk about today.
Lucky I had my AI thingy reading your brain.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my Neuralink. Thanks, Elon. So look, the first thing that I'll say is this, just touching on the first point. I agree that AI is an excellent learning tool. Like it's an excellent learning tool. It's such a good way to bounce ideas off and say, hey, I want to try this. I want to try that. Is this the right thing to do? Is that the wrong thing to do? And I'll give you an example, right? One example is this thing. This would not exist without AI.
You keep forgetting that we don't release the video.
I know. I'm just teasing, right? This would not exist without AI. I'm currently holding up my custom built handheld gaming PC that I made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, arguably it doesn't exist now because it blew up and it's not finished. But
hang on. I just want to correct you there. It exists. It's in your hand.
That's true. Yeah.
It doesn't work, but it still exists.
Here's the shell and the case and the screen. Here's the motherboard.
It doesn't matter. It exists.
It does exist. Look, it exists. And yes, it's got, sorry, I forgot that my speaker doesn't pick up when I face away. Yes, it exists. And yes, it's got some work to do, but it exists and it's there and it will get fixed and it will get finished. And you know what? Without AI, I could have built it, because people built these without AI. It just would have taken me 3 years, 5 years, 10 years instead of 6 months, right?
Yeah. So I think degrees dedicated to that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's a fella up in Brisbane. His name's Dan McKenzie, who's got a YouTube channel, and I recommend everyone checks it out. CNC Dan. He's a local bloke up in Brizzy, and he's built a few of these things, and he's shared his videos on it. He's recently built a sim racing rig himself, and most recently built an open source VR headset. So he's got some cool stuff going on. And so, yeah, you know, he was one of the people. There was another guy there was a few things that inspired me for this. One was kind of Raspberry Pi retro handhelds. Another one was, there was someone that made out of the Framework laptops of that. I don't know if you've seen those, a handheld out of those. So, and then, you know, so I'd been thinking about it and I actually started to build a Raspberry Pi one. And then I ended up buying the bloody thing. And then I saw this guy's channel and I just kept at it. So much of this, the CAD, the 3D printing, the electronics, the software, the firmware, there's so much in there, and I just wouldn't have been able to do it without AI, without it taking a decade of my life.
Yeah.
So it's a good learning tool. Now, in terms of quote unquote vibe coding, or to put it another way, getting it to do our jobs for us.
Yes.
Because here's the main question I want to pose, right? Is AI coming for our jobs? Are we out of a job, right? Is the writing on the wall? Are our days numbered? And the answer is no, it's not. And I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why. I'll get to it. But I'll talk a bit more about how I use AI and how it differs to how you use it slightly. And I think what our expectations are. So I agree that it's not like working with a very senior colleague. It's not like working with you, where we could have a very high level idea of a solution, ensure that we are aligned on it through tools like ubiquitous language or a well-defined backlog, what have you, and delegate parts of it and go off and work on different bits, occasionally having to confer and collaborate, but essentially knowing that we're working towards the same goal and we're going to build something between us that works. No, doesn't work like that, right? In terms of, and this is the part that I'm going to come back to, and this is the part where our jobs are safe, in terms of having it be like a vibe coding solution, where you could be someone who doesn't know how to code, you could be someone that doesn't know how to build enterprise software, and say, I want a CRM system that does this, this, and this, and it's going to disrupt the market and make me millions of dollars, and have it just go off and build it. It's never going to work. Well, maybe one day, I don't know, but that's not where we're at, right?
No, well, but that won't work, because the LLMs built off existing knowledge, right?
Yes,
and
but
to say I want something to disrupt the market, something that's novel, that is brand new, it's not going to be able to do that.
Let me put it another
way. It doesn't know about it.
Let me put it another way, right? If you are trying to come up with a novel algorithm to solve a problem that is currently unsolved, that's going to be problematic. But don't forget what Yuli was telling us about alpha, whichever it is, that's finding new solutions to cancer drug medications and stuff. So, you know, maybe we'll get there, right? But let's say, on the other hand, you are someone like Lucy, who we had on the show recently, right? Well, she launched a product that disrupted the market, but she didn't need new technology or algorithms or things that an LLM theoretically couldn't do. She could have, theoretically, in principle, have vibe-coded Vili, the full stack. In practice, you couldn't have, which is what I want to talk about, but in principle, she could have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to hear what you mean by in practice. But...
So here's the thing, right? We spoke last time about a post, or was it the time before? I don't know. A post that one of us saw online where someone was saying, you know, it was never about whether you could code or not. It was about the fact that we suck at explaining what our requirements are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, let me take a step back and let me tell you how I use AI and specifically how I use Copilot and coding assistants. I see it as, yes, a Copilot, yes, a junior intern, what have you. The long and short of it here is this, right? I have found, and this is again why I went into the big caveat earlier about it being good as a learning tool, and it's different context to when you're using it as a work tool. Now, what I have found when it comes to AI coding assistants is they are very, very good at doing what I already know how to do. They are very, very bad at doing what I don't know how to do. Let me give you some context. If I'm working on a product and I'm writing some code or I'm doing what have you, if I can explain to an AI very, very clearly what I want and I can explain to it and it takes me 5 minutes to explain it and then it takes it 5 minutes to code it, that's potentially a day's work saved.
Yeah.
Now, if I then need to say to it, I don't like what you've done here, or I challenge what you've done here, please explain to me. And you know what? There have actually been times where I've done that. And usually the AI says, yeah, good call. I should refactor it. And what you're saying is better. But yep. There have been times where it says, no, I disagree. And what you're suggesting is not a good idea because X, Y, Z. Rare. But the point is, because I already know how to do what I'm asking it to do, I'm not trying to get it to solve problems for me. Now, it is good for that too, but in a different context. Which I'll come to, but when it comes to coding assistants where I want to give it a task, if I can very clearly explain what I want it to do and correct it when it does it in a way that I don't want it to do it or when things go wrong, it's very, very useful. And if you think about basically boilerplate, like this came up on a call today, right? There was about four or five of us on a call and we were talking about future of AI, and this came up on what we're using for. And I said, yeah, like who here has written a unit test in the past like 3, 6, 12 months? And this one guy said, I'll be honest, I've never written a unit test. And I said, well, you know, don't feel bad. Neither have 90% of developers.
Yeah.
But he said, well, I'm not a developer. It's like, well, fine, right? But, you know, like this is the thing, is 90% of developers probably don't write tests for 90% of their code. And now they do. Do you know what I mean? And the ones that have always written tests, if they're not using AI to do it now, they should be, because it takes minutes. It saves you. It takes minutes to do what would have been a day's work, right? But it can only do that if you already know how to do it, if you're telling it exactly what you want it to do. Now, there are other tools like V0, which is, because I'm not that good, well, I'm not very good at React at all, but I'm not that great at, you know, web in general, web UI, like basically CSS, right? I'm not exactly really a CSS weapon, right? But I can use a tool like V0 and I can get some excellent results in terms of if I say I want this and it spits it out and I get a really good result. But if I then want to do anything with it, it falls over very quickly. Like if I pull that code and I try to modify it, I get frustrated very quickly because I don't like the layering and the plus it's React. I won't go into all the things that are terrible about it, but I get frustrated quickly. So then I go back to V0 and I start asking for changes. And as soon as I hit not even a small level of complexity, but basically if I go past three iterations, it just completely falls over.
Yep.
Right. And that's why I think our jobs are safe. And I think that, you know, it's the same conversation that if we go back to the nobody gives a fuck about your code, right? You know, it's like, yeah, you might be able to spit something out quickly, but as soon as you try to change it, and believe me, you will need to try to change it a lot sooner than you think. This isn't a maintenance down the line tech debt biting us in the ass 5-10 years later. This is, you know, after you show it to someone who isn't you, and you know, one other human being says make this small change, you do that 2-3 times, you're screwed. Right now I find this as well with coding agents, right? So if I try and get a coding agent to solve a problem for me that I don't know how to solve, it's not going to do it quicker than I would do it. And again, I haven't benchmarked it, I haven't timed it, but anecdotally based on my experience, if I don't know how to solve the problem, it takes it a long time.
Yeah.
If I'm not giving it, you know, instructions that explicit that I could go and do it myself, it takes a long time. But if I am, it saves me hours, days, because I can get it to go and do all the boilerplate things, all the things that take up, that eat away all of your time. Remember those estimation lies we tell ourselves?
Yeah.
All those things that you forget to account for, you can get a co-pilot to do, and it will do them, and it just gets them done, and it gets them done quickly. We're not talking about solving, you know, all the world's biggest problems. We're not talking about writing a novel algorithm, although I did get co-pilot to write a new algorithm for me, yeah, which was very interesting. I wanted an indexing algorithm, and I got it to create one, and I should make it public. It's on GitHub. Yeah. It's going to be a Blake plugin, basically, because I've experimented with a whole bunch of things for search for Blake. But anyway, it doesn't matter. That was interesting, but that's very rare. But also, it probably took me as long. No, it didn't take me as long as it would have taken me on my own, but it wasn't a you go and do this and come back to me. It took a lot of effort and a lot of iteration and back and forth to get it to work. But yeah, when it comes to, you know, using Copilot in Visual Studio or VS Code or something like that and getting it to go off and do something, it's very effective at doing the things I already know how to do and can tell it clearly how to do. It's not effective at doing things I don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Now, sorry, go ahead. Because I've got one last example that I want to share on this.
No, I want to hear your example, because I've just got just a random thought, random idea.
Okay. So the other thing that I've been using AI for recently is game dev. So as you know, I dabble in game dev a little bit. I have a bit of an interest in it. And as I'm sure you recall, I actually released a game.
Yes.
Must be 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
5.5 years ago.
It was around 2020.
That's correct. Yes, it was somewhat topical. But yeah, that was probably the first software product publicly that I finished and released.
Yeah,
which was exciting. But that was a game. Yeah. So I dabbled in it a bit, and I have dabbled before then, and since then I've done a bit more for clients. And over the past 6 months or so, I've been getting into it more and more and more. But I'm not an artist, and I'm not a 3D modeler or artist. So I've been using some of the 3D modeling AI tool.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to tell you, it is a very, very humbling experience, because I don't know how to do it. And therefore, I don't know how to tell the AI to do it either. And I look at the results people get on these things, and they are fucking spectacular. It is not the tool. I guarantee you it is not the tool, right? Yeah. The way that people are using these things, and again, don't get me wrong, right? You know, like, yes, I'm not saying that 3D artists are getting replaced. They're not. Like, the things that the work that these things spit out is not there yet, but it's a lot closer to there than what I can churn out, right? You know, and because what I can turn out is I can maybe put a couple of boxes on the screen, and if you're lucky, that's it, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot better than what I can do. And it's certainly good enough for me to get to the point where it's a prototype that I can potentially start using and showing people and start getting feedback on, and get to the point where I can go to an artist and hire someone and get them to do it. It's not production ready, but you know, I look at what other people are churning out, and there are people that are getting some really, really spectacular results with these tools, and not just, you know, the demo assets that the people that own these companies are making, people on Discord forums and everything else, and on Reddit and you know, showing off what they're doing, and they're getting a lot better results than me because they know how to do it. These are 3D artists, yep, or at least people that have studied the craft enough to know how to prompt the tools properly to get the results they want. And like I said, it's a very, very humbling experience. And, you know, looking at what I'm getting out of it, it's very clear to me that AI as a tool to do things for people that already know how to do those things is going to be exceptional. But for people that don't know how to do it, yeah, it's going to be fun, and you're going to get results that you couldn't get without it, but you're not going to get anywhere close to probably what you think you can.
So I think an analogy there that just comes to mind is photography.
Yeah.
Right. I can give a $10,000 camera to a complete amateur, and I can give my phone camera to a professional, and the professional's photo will always come out better.
100%.
It'll be a far better photo, right?
Yep, exactly.
It's not the tool. It's the experience. It's the person using that tool.
Exactly. A camera, no matter how sophisticated, isn't even the iPhone cameras, right, which have got a lot of AI in them, and a lot of, you know, the optics are good, but they're not as good as how the pictures come out, because they've got a lot of AI that compensates for all of your composition, right?
Yep.
But it's never gonna handle the framing for you.
No.
Well, actually, it is. But that's another thing.
No, but it's the timing, it's the framing, it's the mood, the feel, like it's understanding what is the best shot.
And yeah, exactly.
There is just so much more to it that a professional understands that an amateur doesn't. But obviously,
exactly.
Yes. And the professional with the best tools is going to take a really fucking awesome shot, but they don't need them. The camera is not the one that makes the shot. It's the person pulling the trigger.
Well, like, this is the thing. It's like the work that I do with AI in terms of my coding work, the stuff that I do with a coding assistant, I could do without it, but it would take me 10 times longer.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. It's like you said, it's a tool. And, you know, I guess it's similar to what you're saying about the camera. Is like, you know, you give a professional a disposable camera from, you know, the pharmacy, and they're going to get better pictures than, you know, I would get with a $10,000, you know, Red or, you know, Canon top of the line or something, you know, but they're still going to appreciate that tool and get a lot better out of it than they would with your pharmacy disposable, right?
Oh, 100%. So I was going to bring something up and I can't remember what it was now.
I was going to say, you can almost think about it along the same lines, right? So a professional photographer is going to have a lot of post-processing tools. So back in the day, they would have had a dark room and they would have had a whole bunch of different chemical mixes and setups and lighting.
As an aside, have you ever been in a dark room and actually developed a negative and developed the print and watched the print just come to life in front of you?
No, I haven't.
It's a pretty fucking cool experience.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. But anyway, nowadays people use Lightroom, or not so much anymore because everyone hates Adobe.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, have you seen all the drama that's going on around Affinity Photo? Affinity?
No.
Off topic. Yeah, it's a familiar story. But anyway, so something like Lightroom or another post-processing tool, where I was going is that, you know, your photographer with their $10,000 camera is probably going to spend a lot less time post-processing than they are with their pharmacy disposable, right?
Yes. And they're also going to spend less time post-processing than the amateur, probably because chances are they've made less mistakes in the field.
I mean, arguably, the amateur might look at their picture that they've taken and think, well, that's my picture, whereas a pro might know how to post-process.
But the other, I was going to say two things there, right? One, the pro, you'd hope that they've made less mistakes in the field. But two, they've got their tooling set up, so there's a lot of automations in play.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Right? So they're not digging in as much. So again, I think it's...
Well, look at it, let's tie the analogy back to coding, right? So they've probably already got their presets defined on their camera, right? So... Mm-hmm. When anything happens, as soon as they want to nab a shot, they whack a shortcut key and boom, they're in their preset. So they've already dialed in their ISO, their aperture, everything is ready to go, bang, right? Whereas me, for example, I've got some pretty decent shots in my camera, but I you know, I kind of have to cycle because I don't really know, you know, what the f-stop and the, you know, everything else. Like, I've got a vague understanding, but I kind of cycle through them and dial it in until I'm happy with what I've got, you know. So if I was trying to nab a very quick picture, no, that's not going to happen. Whereas they've got all their presets in place. Well, the equivalent, you could say, is your...
Sorry, just not only that, they would be able to look outside and just go, given the lighting at the moment, these are the settings. Yeah. This is the rough range of settings I'd be using, and then they'd dial it in from there.
Yeah, even without the preset. Yeah. So the equivalent might be your Copilot instructions, right? So if you think of your repo as a camera, and you think of your Copilot instructions as your settings, you might have tuned them and dialed them in, and you would know how to tell Copilot what instructions to use based on what your repo is doing, right? So, you know, if you're building a simple web API with some forms and some CRUD, you know what to tell it about that. If you're building an enterprise application with distributed architecture where you've got things that need to happen asynchronously and know what they're doing, so on and so forth. And I forgot that that's what I was going to say about that, because you mentioned that Scott Hanselman and Mark Rusinovich brought that up. And you also said that, you know, the LLM's memory is limited and the amount of context it can store in memory is limited as well. A neat trick that I've been doing over the past few weeks, I found, is if I'm having a long conversation with an agent and we're going through lots of iterations and we're doing lots of work, it starts to slow down and the quality notably starts to degrade.
Yep.
So what I do is I get to a point where I say, summarize this whole conversation, all the key points in a document, put it in the docs folder, fill it, start a new conversation, give it that context.
And again, back to that novel writing scenario, right? Obviously, there's a lot of text involved. And so from the very beginning, I was doing the exact same thing, right?
Yeah.
You get to the end of the chapter, summarize this chapter.
Yeah.
Summarize the key point. Because obviously, if you're moving forward, you need to be able to track a lot of what's happened in the past.
Yeah.
So yes, you do need those summaries. And I think that's a great tip for anything that's long running like that. You do need to make sure that you need to be aware of the context window. And if you are going to go well beyond that, to basically have your summaries in place so that you can maintain as much context as possible, much relevant context as possible.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, like, this is the thing. We're all learning. Like, it's a new technology and we're all figuring out how to use it. It's in its infancy. It's not at the stage where, and this is the thing, it's not like it's a pipe dream. It's not like we're talking sci-fi here. We are on the cusp of it. And it's like, it's so tantalizingly close because it's kind of the capabilities there. It's just, we just haven't quite built it out yet.
Yeah.
So we're pretty close to that, you know, if not artificial general intelligence, something that is able to approximate it to the point where it doesn't matter. It makes no difference.
Yep. Which is a scary, but too exciting.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's scary to know, well, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for our jobs? But I mean, the exciting part is, well, what does it mean for our job?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. What happens next? What jobs do we get? What are we doing instead of what we're doing now? And I've always said, right, the work that you and I are doing today did not exist when you were as young as your kid.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Your job right now did not exist when you were as young as your children. So there is a really high likelihood the jobs that they undertake, that the careers that they take do not exist right now. And we do not know what they are.
Yeah.
And we're at that point where I think there's a big turning point with the age of AI, that there will be in the near future, a large number of jobs are going to come to fruition that we just cannot fathom what they are right now. And to me, that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
The scary part is now I need to learn something new.
But that's also exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Like, I've got a lot of things I want to make and a lot of things I want to build. And the likelihood of, if you think of like a chart with two kind of, you know, inversely proportional lines on it, you know, the likelihood of me getting through my backlog is steadily going from zero to something that isn't zero. You know, it's still probably off zero. It's nowhere near one yet. But you know, equally, the probability of my backlog running out and me running out of things to do and having capacity to do things, that's also steadily becoming non-zero.
Yeah. I'm finding at the moment I have so many projects that I would love to tackle, so many things I want to do, but I just don't have the time or the energy or I guess it's time and energy, really, right? That I just do not have to justify doing them right now. They fall back on the priority.
You know what the telling thing about that is?
What's that?
Well, but now we've got AI, we've got, you know, vibe coding, we've got agents. It tells a whole story in itself, the fact that you've unconsciously acknowledged that even if you wanted to go and get agents to do all that for you, the amount of effort and mental and emotional investment it will take from you even to just get agents to do it for you is still significant.
Absolutely. Absolutely is significant. And it's like when you see those memes about software engineers, right? Where, you know, there's a problem, or engineers in general, it is, right? There's a problem that could be solved within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But the engineer goes out of their way to spend 2 or 3 days designing a solution that's going to solve that problem, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I feel, for me, that's what I feel AI and AI agents right now is, right? It's for me to build the agents and to build up that workforce, so to speak, to do what I need it to do is a heavy lift. It's a big task to do what I need. But the flip side of that is I don't get through my to-do list because I don't have anyone to help me get through that to-do list.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
can I tell you a funny story?
Probably absolutely. Not.
When I was at uni, I remember, I'm going to change this story slightly for what makes
to protect the innocent.
To protect myself, I'm the innocent. I'll just say that it wasn't really alcohol, but I was at a party at uni once. And there was a few of us, and someone was going to a run to the off license. That's what we call the bottle shop in the UK, to get some alcohol to stock up on some booze for the party, right? And there was some people had, you know, five quid, a fiver to chuck in. Some people had a tenner. Some people had 20. Some people was like, oh, I've only got, you know, a couple of quid I can throw in. And we're trying to work out, well, what do we get? Because also some people wanted wine, shall we say, and someone wanted vodka, and someone wanted some beers. And yeah, going from memory here, whatever. And we're trying to work out, well, with our pool of funds, what do we get? Like, so, you know, there's only two people going to the shop. What are we going to get that's going to kind of work this out? So what do we get? We get like a couple of bottles of wine, a bottle of vodka, from beers. Oh no, but then what about this? Blah 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 blah. And I got my notepad out and I got a pen out. Oh no, they actually said to me, so they said, Matt, what do you think? And I was like, I'll tell you. And I got my notepad and I got my pen and I started scribbling away like 3 or 4 pages. I was, they're like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm trying to like work out the formula here for like what you put in and what you get out. And like, we're all like already like probably, you know, I don't know how many beers deep at this point, but we've had a few, and like, you know, everyone's like, you fucking dickhead, or whatever. And I'm like, no, there's a fucking formula, I'm telling you. And they're like, there isn't a formula. Oh my God, what are you doing? And by the time I'd looked up and like, oh, hey, where is everyone? Like, they've already worked out and they've gone, they'll be back in 10 minutes. And I looked down and I still am no closer to working out what this freaking formula is.
So you were AIing back then.
Yeah.
You look at it now and you'd still look at the algorithms that come out and just go, I don't know what the fuck you're doing.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Except at that point it was my intelligence.
Alcoholic intelligence.
Yeah, that's right. The funny thing is like, I'm not even a mathematician or like, you know, an engineer in terms of that kind of engineering, but I just decided, no, there's a formula. I'm going to figure it out. And the funny thing is that like, there isn't a formula. There's no way there's a formula. Maybe there is a model. Anyway, let's not go down that rabbit hole. But yes, the memes are accurate.
Yeah. But I don't know. I remember not long after ChatGPT was released and there was so much hype about it at the time, and was to see an AI tool actually do what it was doing at that point. I remember writing an article about it, basically questioning, do I feel threatened by AI and will it take my job? And at that point, like, I didn't take the stance that no, my job's not, like, AI will never be able to write code. Because, you know, back then it was a conversational bot, right? It wasn't a great deal around writing code. Copilot had just started to come out. And my point there was, it was a tool for us to use to help us get our jobs done.
Yeah.
Right. There's a reason why Microsoft call it Copilot.
Yeah.
Not Pilot. But Copilot.
Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, right, my entire career of being a software engineer in Australia, my job has always been at threat of being outsourced.
Yeah.
Right? My job has always been cheaper to get resources overseas to do my job.
Yeah.
But I've never found a shortage of jobs in Australia.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what's interesting about that is that I'm currently working on a project with an offshore team, and this is a team from a less expensive country than this one, but it's not like, it's not what you think. Like, we've spoken about this before because we have worked with these kind of resources before, where it's almost like the call center type setup where it's just bums on seats and high churn and find cheap resources and bring them in. This isn't like that. These are very senior, very experienced, very capable, very intelligent consultants who could do our jobs with the clients that we work with.
Yep.
They're just in a different country that costs less. Like, they are very good. And they're working on these kind of projects on the same team that I'm on, you know? And I think while there has always been the availability of cheap, low cost, low quality resources, I think these high quality resources available overseas at lower prices has always been available as well.
Yep.
And I think that the point you're making, which is valid, is that that's, you know, that's never been a threat. I think there is always demand for people that can respond to a phone call and say, you know, I need you to come into the office or come and help me with this, or,
well, yeah, I think there is,
you know.
And it's, you know, part of the argument, like, it's not just a time zone argument. There's also the cultural argument, right?
Yeah.
You understand our culture. You understand, like, just back to the ubiquitous language, right? If you add the cultural angle to it, all of a sudden your ubiquitous dictionary has to get larger. Right?
I don't disagree, but just to play devil's advocate, so to speak, in my experience, Anglo-Western countries, our culture is much better understood by people from other cultures and other countries than theirs is by us.
Yeah, I'm choosing my words correctly here, right? I agree, but I don't have any data to back that up.
Yeah, fair enough. Right. I mean, the point I'm trying to get at is, like, these people that I'm speaking about, the people that I'm working with on this project at the moment, they're based in another country and they are less expensive than we are,
yeah,
but they would not struggle working with the clients that we work with on the projects that we work with as much as juniors from this country do.
So I've always said, too, when it comes to the outsourcing argument, there's the whole idea that you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
But that does not mean you get what you pay for.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right. I've worked with people here in Australia getting good money that are not good developers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have dealt with offshore developers earning far less money that have produced good product.
Yeah. You know what I think is a good analogy for this, right?
What's that?
If you think about retail and you think about Harvey Norman, JB Hi-Fi, right?
Yep.
Like, Yes, if you know, let's say I want a laptop, right? So yes, I can buy a MacBook Pro, or I can buy a top of the line Lenovo, or, you know, Lenovo's a Chinese company, but, you know, whatever, right? I can buy a top of the line, you know, laptop, what have you, or I can go and buy a cheap Temu, you know, laptop that's going to have a Celeron processor in it, and it's going to have a 1 terabyte drive that's actually only got 16 gig, but reports that it's got a terabyte, and it's going to run like dog shit, but, you know, you get what you pay for. Yeah. But equally, I can buy that same top spec Lenovo laptop from Amazon and have it shipped from somewhere overseas and save 40% versus buying it from a big box retailer here. So, like, yes, you get what you pay for, and yes, you can get your much cheaper products and you're going to get a much cheaper experience. But if you can find the same quality of product cheaper elsewhere, you're still getting the same quality of product.
Absolutely. Now, there's another layer on top of that that I'm sort of tackling from a business perspective too. And that's, what's the word that I'm after? And that's the, I guess, that's the more social responsibility side of things, right? As an Australian citizen, as an Australian-based company, I want to use Australian-based resources.
Yep.
Because I want to support the Australian economy.
Yep.
Right? I would much rather have that money not going overseas, but staying onshore. And look, it's not for everyone, right? Not every client is willing to pay a premium to stay onshore.
But do you know what the funny part of that is?
What's that?
Nearly every client, and I say nearly because I don't know for certain that this is every client, but every client that I have worked directly with, they want someone onshore. Like, even if they don't want to pay the premium and they want less expensive resources from overseas to do the work, they want at least one person onshore.
Yeah.
Either supervising or managing or the quote unquote throat to choke. And I say this, and I caveated with nearly every, because I, you know, I can't qualify that, but I can qualify that every team or project that I have worked on where the client has used less expensive overseas resources, they have wanted an onshore resource that they can that they can delegate to supervise it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a model that has, I mean, it's worked. I've heard people working for PMall.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you just don't know if it's been said or if it's been cut, but it doesn't work all the time.
It doesn't work all the time. I mean, yeah, like we know of a company that was doing quite well for a while and was using that model, and it didn't work out for unrelated reasons. But, you know, there's another client of mine that we both know of that is doing that model now. And before I was working for them, they were doing a different approach and it didn't work.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, and I have no idea.
It's the same. No, it's the same. It's the same with AI, right? It's like, I think this is, you know, this is, Yuli said this, and it's not his quote, you know, this is quite a common thing to say, but, and what you were saying about our jobs changing and the nature of our work, we're all going to become better managers because our job will be managing coding agents or agents doing whatever job it is people do, right?
We'll be better delegated.
Some of us will.
It's a skill I need to learn.
You weren't the person I was thinking of, but sure. But yeah, I mean, the point is that it's the same model. You know, if the model hasn't worked for you of using cheap offshore resources without a skilled individual that you are delegating through, it's not going to work with AI either.
That was the point I was trying to make. Yeah. I'm just not as articulate as you.
I could see you trying to get the words out, so I thought I'd help. Turns out I am a wordsmith.
Yeah, well, you're a published author. Of course you're a wordsmith.
Don't tell anyone, but ChatGPT wrote that book. Can't you tell? It's full of EM dashes and emoji.
Does it predate ChatGPT?
No, well, yes. I mean, the start of it predates ChatGPT, but I use ChatGPT on the book. But I mean, this is the thing. It's like, I wasn't using ChatGPT to write the book for me. I was using it for things like breaking writer's block.
Yep.
Like, so, you know, if I was sort of stuck on the start of a chapter, and what I used to do was agonize over it for days and go days without writing anything until eventually I have a breakthrough and come back and start. And then as I got a little bit mature, I moved on to putting placeholder notes and just moving on and coming back eventually when I was forced to.
Yep.
But what I found with ChatGPT is that I could give it those bullet points and say, write my chapter opening, and then it would write it. And I wouldn't be able to use that. And I wouldn't. It was my book. Do you know what I mean? I didn't use anything ChatGPT wrote in that book. But it would be enough to break that writer's block.
Sure.
Things like that. Things like, one of the things that I'm very bad at as a writer is being succinct or concise. Mm-hmm. Not just as a writer, as a speaker as well.
Yep.
So, you know, going to ChatGPT and saying, here's 3,000 words, I need to say this in 500.
Yeah. Funny, that just reminds me of one of the points that I was listening to in the Data and Drams podcast this morning that Louise Kelly's made about basically putting together a business case to get a project across the line internally or internally, externally, and, you know, making sure that it got to the right person and all that. And basically the advice she was given was you write out your business case, right? It might be a full 20-page plan. And so you write that down. And the next step, take that and summarize it into 10 pages.
Yeah.
Next step, summarize it down to 4 pages. The next one, summarize it down to 2.
Yeah.
Then summarize it down to like a 2-sentence elevator pitch.
You know what's really interesting?
Yep.
Yeah. That's excellent. That's an excellent idea. You just reminded me of one of the other points that I made a mental note earlier to talk about today on this topic that I completely slipped my mind until you just said that. So what I was saying earlier about using coding assistants like Copilot and getting it to help with the things that we already know how to do, right? At the moment, the way that we work is we have one agent, right? So be it Copilot on GitHub where you open an issue and assign it to Copilot, be it an agent in your chat bar, in your IDE, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got one agent that does one thing, and you have to have a bit of back and forth, and you have to have, you know, well, actually, I want to challenge this, I want you to change that, so on and so forth.
Yep.
Where I really see this going is actually having adversarial, not necessarily adversarial, but call them rubber ducking or pair programming agents, right?
Yep.
I would love it if I had 2 agents that were there, and, you know, I would say to them as a team, go do this, and one of them goes and does something, and then the other one red teams it, and it comes back and says, this is bad because this, they challenge each other and get to a point where by the time it gets to me, I'm like, well, there's no way I could do better than that. That's amazing. And I think that's very viable. Like, I think that's absolutely viable.
Didn't
you know what?
Yuli described that? Was that RAG?
No, GAN.
GAN.
Yeah. So adversarial. So
yeah.
Generative adversarial networks or something like that. So that is an approach that is used in different contexts. So kind of specifically for security and red teaming, right?
Mm.
So if you've got one agent that is coming up with new security things and you've got another one that's trying to break them and they're, you know, locked in a cold war essentially, like that, but a bit more productive and a bit less aggressive. So, you know, like, I mean, if I have Copilot sitting in Visual Studio and I say, write this code that does this and here are the instructions, and it goes off and does it, and then I look at it and I say, that's really good. I would like this changed. I would like that changed. I'm not sure about this. What do you think of so on and so forth? But if there was another agent doing that, just challenging it, and they were challenging each other until they get to the stage where they present it to me and it's basically ready to go, and it blows my mind because it's like better than I could do. I think that's very viable and very doable. And the thing that I think is interesting about that is that it's kind of modeled on how we work, right? Because you write some code and then you look at it and you think, how can I improve it? Or what's wrong with this? I mean, you don't literally sit there and write out code and then it's perfect and you ship it. Do you know what I mean? You look at it and you tweak it and you change it and you think, what can I improve? Basically, Liam, inside you, there are two wolves.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to leave it there.
So I want to jump on that one, but just to finish off my train of thought, the one thing that Louise mentioned in that, when you've got all those different documents, is none of that's wasted.
Mm.
Each of those documents has a specific audience, right? The 2-sentence elevator pitch, well, that's for the executive stakeholder that you need to sell this idea to. The 20-page, you know, the 20-page business plan outline, that's for the implementation team.
Yeah.
And there's various stakeholders in the middle that need those other versions. So you're still doing the work that needs to be done across the board, right? None of it is waste.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really valuable takeaway. And again, this is something I completely forgot about until just now, and this is why I needed to write it down while I was driving.
Yeah.
Then there's back to those two little, the devil and the angel sitting on your shoulder, right? Is that what you were saying?
Not exactly, but I do like that one. Yeah. I think I'm going to use that for the thumbnail.
Look, I like that idea. But yeah, I think actually that's what I was going to say. You're right. We never do write something that worked perfectly the first time around. But the model I think it's
a step beyond that. It's not about if it works. I mean, I think even before you even run your first test or even try and run it, you write it and you look at it and you edit it before you even commit it, right?
But one thing I work towards, and I try to tell everyone, well, this is how I like to work, is it's a 3-step process. First step is just make the thing work.
Yeah.
Right. You make it work, just get it done. The second step is do it right. Right. That's when you can go in and you can start to, you know, let's just make sure this is the right way to do it, in quote.
Yeah.
There's no point in making it the right way to do it if you haven't actually got it work. And then the last step is to make it far.
Yeah.
Right. To optimize it. Right. Because you don't need to, you may not need to actually do that optimization. And there's that old famous quote, the premature optimization is the root of all evil, which usually gets truncated at that point. But yeah. I do believe the quote goes a lot further than that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's sort of an extension on that, right? Let's start at the point of just get the algorithm, the method, or whatever you're working on, just to do what you want it to do.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be pretty. Doesn't have to be fast. Just get it to work. Right. That, and you know what? That might be all you ever need to do.
Yeah.
You might be able to release it at that point.
Yeah.
And forget about it.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, the proof of concept that goes out to production that's there holding up the 18-story skyscraper. Sorry, 18-story skyscraper.
The XKCD cartoon with all the blocks just held up. But
we have been going for an hour and a half.
We have, yeah. And I believe that is last orders because my bottle's empty and it's probably for the best, to be honest, because I probably shouldn't be drinking any more of that.
Well, in case you're after it, that's what I was drinking.
I did clop that one, yeah.
A couple more because I've got my fermenters going away. Hopefully next time we record, that will be done.
Actually, yeah, good idea. I'll bust out one of my brews for our next episode as well.
Which, actually, as we're wrapping up, the next episode will be quite exciting.
Will it?
Because we'll be announcing...
Are they not all quite exciting?
But this one we'll be able to actually announce a giveaway.
AdaConf winners.
Exactly. That would make it exciting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that will be exciting. That's cool. I'm looking forward to AdaConf. I'm pretty excited.
I am. I actually... finally got around to getting my flights and accommodation all sorted. Okay, well, I'm getting kicked out, I think.
Yeah, they called last orders. The bell's ringing. They want to go home.
Yep.
I don't know who the they are. It's us, really.
And yes, I do want to go home.
Mm. Well, I don't know about you, but it's way past my bedtime. I'm getting tired. But I, for one, am probably not going to be kept awake tonight worrying about AI taking my job. And you know what? I said it before, and I'll say it again. I'm kind of hoping AI takes my job.
Yeah, I think, well, I agree. I'm not going to lose sleep about AI taking my job. But yeah, like I said, I'm excited to see what's around the corner because there will be jobs that we don't know about that are coming.
Yeah, fingers crossed we're not too old to jump on the bandwagon. So.
See how that plans out. Otherwise, just need to win that lotto.
Yeah.
Or wait for the universal basic income.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs Mart. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Actually, yesterday was too hot. Today was too cold. Yeah, fucking all right, Goldilocks.
Is this Goldilocks? I like it. I was going to say, or is this just where I could start to call you a whinging bomb?